Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.
I knew I first found out that you were a writer through Bill Hertz, because the credits go by awfully fast, and that's, you know.
They do, particularly in Jay Ward product. As a matter of fact, when we did the short set of titles for the Bullwinkle show, they are literally going by so fast that they're almost strobing.
Is that the one with the train?
Yeah, they're just impossible to read. Just impossible. If you look at one credit, you might be able to follow it across the screen, but being able to read up and down, you just can't do it. Yeah. But then again, we had so many people that Jay wanted to give credit to, and all the names are on there. We had one credit, which was which probably the best one that we've done. We got one shot, one frame, and we put everybody's name on it, upside down, backwards, sideways, 14 different typefaces. And then we just left that on for the entire time. You could always find whoever you wanted to find on there. But we did that one time, too.
Okay, before we get into Bullwinkle too much, I know you've done a lot of other things besides Jay Ward. And where did you first get involved with the entertainment industry?
I'd been an animation buff for a long time. Loved animation. Loved cartoons. And when I just graduated from college with a drama major from the University of Denver, and a fellow who's also an animation buff in Denver, named Bill Turnbull, and I started working together, teaching ourselves to animate. He did some title work for local films, Alexander Films and a couple of others. He had built himself a multiplane, if you can imagine that, a multiplane out of spit string wire, old boards, and it worked. And so we decided to try some animation. And I was really trying to teach myself to animate when World War II intervened, and I became a photographer for the Air Force, that being one of my hobbies.
You're inside of planes taking pictures of...
That was the theory, anyway. Yeah. That's what I trained.
I just saw that the other day in a Spencer Tracy movie.
Yeah, I was trained to be an aerial photographer. And I also like to act. When I was sent down to Colorado Springs, and in my off-duty hours, I tried out for a play, The Man Who Came to Dinner, which was being done for some benefit, I believe for the camp newspaper. And just before the play opened, my transfer orders came, sent me out to a combat camera crew assignment, training in Culver City. And I couldn't go, so I have my orders delayed by 60 days and did the run of the play, which meant that I was out here all by myself. When I came out on individual orders. Everybody who came out in that particular thing had already been trained and gone overseas and were having their asses shot off, I suppose, from various places. And I fell into this gap between one combat camera crew being trained and another combat camera crew being trained. And I found I had an animation unit on the post. This was the first motion picture unit. It was like dying and going to heaven, actually. I'd never known anything about California or movies or Hollywood. And I came out to the glories of the Union Station, which was in its heyday, saw my first palm tree.
Yeah, right there.
Got a private car to take me to the motion picture unit, because nobody knew exactly where it was. The motion picture unit had moved. It had been where the ABC studios are now. And they had moved it. They had moved it to what was later renamed as Fort Roach. Hal Roach had turned over his studio to the Air Force for the duration of the war. So there I am, an old movie buff, and I walk in the gates of the Hal Roach studio.
Yeah.
down the company street, which was the New York street that I had seen in many, many movies. Reported to the first sergeant, and he said, "Where the hell have you been? You're AWOL. You better see the personnel officer." So I walked into the personnel officer, and I said, "Private Scott reporting." And he said, "Oh, sit down." And I looked up, and it was Ronald Reagan who was the personnel officer. That was in his flaming liberal days, so I was delighted to see him. As I said, it was like dying and going to heaven.
Yeah.
Then I found out they had an animation unit. And I tried desperately. I started out loading films, standing in a dark room for 6 hours a day. That really is not a very invigorating specialty. And I began, they took me on in the animation unit, and I began my career washing cells. At that time, cells very difficult to get. And in order that they would have enough, particularly for slip cells that you put in between other cells, they took all the old animation, they wash all the paint and ink off it,
wow,
and polish them up and use them over again. And that was my duty. I stood in a little back room at a sink and polished cells for a while until I talked somebody into letting me become an apprentice in-betweener. And I worked my way up from being an apprentice in-betweener to being a kind of a half-ass assistant for some people who were up to that point had only been named, glorious names to me. Phil Monroe, Rudy LaRiva, Bill Hertz. You know, I'd seen these as screen credits, but actually meeting the people, wow-wee, that was something. So I
know the feeling.
It was just glorious for me. And I spent the next 3 years at their first motion picture unit in Culver City, and fortunately for me, I had also, among my other qualifications, I had an Army driver's license. They had given me that back in Colorado Springs, when I took on the job of being a driver while I was waiting to come out here. So they had to find something for me to do, so I got a driver's license, and I was chauffeuring a squadron commander in a staff car. That's my job. So I had an Army driver's license. So while other more qualified people came and went in the first motion picture unit, animation, I stayed on because I was the only one who could drive them out to the rifle range and back. Anytime we had to go off the post for anything, they needed qualified Army drivers. And I think that and the fact that I knew close order drill very well were the real reasons that I was able to stick around in the animation business as long as I did. At the end of the war, I went to OCS and got a commission and then came back and got my first job recommended by Phil Monroe at Warner Brothers. I worked at Warner Brothers as a co-writer with Lloyd Turner. Lloyd Turner is now, I think, producer of The Jeffersons, and he's a very knowledgeable and fun guy to work with. Anyway, we worked together for a year. At the end of that year, they decided they were going to keep one of us on and fire one of us. So we were each given a story to do on our own. And whoever's story was the best, he would stay on and the other one got fired. Both of us are terrified. We had, you know, the terrible conditions under which to work.
Yeah, really.
So we ignored it. And we worked together the same as we had before, only we turned out two stories instead of one story. And we flipped the coin to see whose story was going to be whose. Lloyd's story won, and my story didn't. So I got fired, he stayed on.
Sure.
I guess the next thing that I did was for Bob Clampett, who was doing Time for Beanie as a puppet show at the time. And I worked as a writer and sometime puppeteer.
I saw one of those beanies go by too.
Yeah. with a writer named Charlie Shows. Wonderful archetype. Just a character. It was unbelievable. Anyway, Charlie and I worked for about 6 months. And then I made the mistake of asking for more money and whoosh, was out. That's still a very bitter memory for me. Anyway, that the
I've heard other bitter memories from I've spent extensive hours with Dawes Butler
So he's told you all about Mr. Clampett, I suppose.
Yeah, he told me a bit about. And I just got another talking to about Mr. Clampett from June. Hooray.
Ever get a chance to talk to Chuck Jones, don't bring up the subject, because Jones will begin to foam at the mouth.
Well,
so I worked for Benny for about, I guess, about 6-7 months.
Yeah.
And the next shot was at UPA. At that time, I had done some freelance for them.
Before you go on, yeah, sure. about time for Beanie, yeah. Was there anything that you cooked up, any ideas that I would know, the public would know? Any particular stories that you...
The major thing that we had going for us when I was there was an episode concerning the two-headed freep. It was one of those quests that never ended. Uh-huh. It went on and on and on and on. The story had already been in existence when I came on. And when I left, I think we had just finished up the two-headed freep and were going on to another episode. But that was the major thing. The two-headed freep, of course, being very unusual because most freeps have three heads. Mm-hmm. And that was our big moment. We knew we had to produce the two-headed freep that everybody had been looking for weeks and months. And what the hell was the two-headed freep going to look like? And we kept stalling and stalling and stalling and stalling and stalling. We finally got a cockamamie arm puppet that was a crazy-looking character with a beanie hat on it, because Beanie wore the beanie with a propeller on the top. And the two-headed freep had been watching Beanie on television all the time and knew exactly what was going on. And so this one head wore this crazy hat. The other head was in a paper sack, because we couldn't think yet of what the other head was going to look like. And I think it was just about the day that we had to do it that we finally just put a black sock over Stan Freeberg's hand and a pair of eyes on it, shoved the sock in to make a mouth. And it was hilarious. It was exactly right. Freeberg was a fine puppeteer, and he was able to get a lot of character and a lot of emotion and a lot of movement in just this crazy mouth going with these two eyes wiggling about on the top of it. And it was laid back enough and such a difference from this very ornate head on the other side that it was very successful. When the paper bag came off and the close-up went in on the second head of the two-headed freep, the TV crew went ape. They were in convulsions. If you ever hear that Kenny, you'll just hear raucous laughter and falling down and whatnot going on in the studio, because it was just exactly right. So that was the major thing we worked on. The big hassle came because at the time we were doing that, we were also working on a second television series to be called Buffalo Billy, and I was drawing characters for that. Charlie Shoes is a wonderful story. I drew characters all the time. I wouldn't like him. I'd toss him in the wastebasket. Charlie came back late one night because he'd forgotten something, walked into our office, and there was Clampett pulling the drawings out of the wastebasket and putting copyright Bob Clampett on them and saving all the discards, after hours. That was a real Clampett, story. So anything more you want to know about Time for Bean?
Well, the thing is that I noticed is that there's a lot of character names. There's a lot of unusual names, if you look down the list of characters, And the thing is that Bob will tell me he did everything. I mean, he'll tell me he did everything that he... Did
he saved, he did. Dawes Butler can give you the real scam on the beginning and the development and everything else. If he's given you the story on the beginning of Time for Beanie, that is the true story.
Yeah.
Indeed, it was his wife, Myrtis, who came up with Cecil the Sea Serpent, and not Bob Clampett or Bob Clampett's mother. And Clampett's participation in the show when I was on it consisted in his showing up 15 minutes before we went on the air and leaving 5 minutes after we went off the air. Mm-hmm. He sat in the control booth while we were on the air. One of the reasons it was so difficult to get anything set up on the new shows, and one of the reasons we got into trouble about it, was that he was unavailable. He was completely unavailable. Mm-hmm. I suppose Dawes has told you one of the great window stories. Mm-hmm. No? We wanted to talk about...
No, I haven't heard one of those.
He's done this.
You mean the control room window?
No. Two occasions he's done it. We set up a meeting with Bob at his home because we couldn't get him anywhere else. He would meet us on Saturday morning at his home on Detroit Avenue. And we arrived, I think it were three or four of us. We arrived and he took us into his study. At the very pleasant room with the big French windows looking out on the garden and whatnot. We all sat down, and his mother brought in coffee for us. And we passed the time of day. And while we were passing the day, Bob said, "Excuse me a minute, will you, fellas?" And he opened the French doors and stepped out. And we waited for half an hour. 45 minutes. Finally, Bill Oberlund was one of our technical guy. He showed up late at the thing. And he said, "Isn't Bob going to be here?" I said, "Yeah, he stepped out. He said he'd be back." He said, "I saw him walking down Wilshire Boulevard, going the other way, about three blocks away. He just disappeared. He just would not do it." And I've heard the story repeated.
He didn't want to be confronted with things.
Just couldn't handle this kind of thing and just disappeared. Not a word. Dawes remembers that. And that happened, I guess, with somebody else. He'd done exactly the same thing. Called him in and said, "Just a minute," and left. Would not that's very difficult to work with a guy.
What's behind it? I won't repeat that, but I appreciate you sharing the story.
Oh, sure. That was one of the great moments down at the...
You know, when I first met with him, he first said that I could not tape anything. And I said, "Well, I couldn't remember anything. I couldn't, you know." Because if we started doing it with a pencil and paper, and I started asking him, to slow down a little bit, let me write this down. And he said, "Listen, it's not going to work. We've got to tape it." So he typed up a page and he had me sign a paper saying that everything had to be to his agreement before anything would be used. So he really took the precaution that he,
he's a very scared fella. Yeah,
he's kind of scared. Anyway, let's move on.
Oh well, as an addenda to that
particular
story, I was asked down to the Comic-Con convention in San Diego last year. They were very nice enough to give me one of the Inkpot Awards. And Clampett was there. Now, that's the first time that I had seen Clampett since I left the Beanie Show. Face to face.
That's strange.
And he's in on his, he's got his little boy wig. He came in with his little boy wig on and...
The black toupee.
Yeah, the black toupee. And came over smiling and smiling. Aren't you the real Bill Scott? And I said, are you the real Bob Clampett? Well, he said, "How long has it been? Years." I said, "Last time I saw you, Bob, is when you fired me." Well, that's a long... He left and went over to his table. And about 20 minutes later, I guess it was, he came over to the table again. He said, "Someday, if you want to know the real story about that, I'll tell you." I said, "I don't have to. I was there, Bob. You don't have to tell me the story." So that was the only time that I've seen Clampett in those 20 years.
I think with him, it's easy to remember what he wants to remember, and it's easy to forget what he wants to forget.
You know? I know that is... very difficult thing. I swore to God when I first began to hear stories about experiences that I had had and things that I had myself gone through and saw how strangely warped they got around. When I saw my own credits slowly disappearing into the great beyond, promised myself that I would always try to remember who did what. Mm-hmm. And if I really don't know, then I don't know. But I certainly am not going to, because believe me, it's easy enough for me to say, sure, I wrote everything.
Yeah.
Sure, I wrote everything.
June says to me, set that record straight, Paul. Because, you know, the book that I'm doing really is the first of its kind, and I think it'll be a monumental mark. You know, it's going to be a big book.
I think you've got a great big project in hand.
Oh, it's
great
big. It's something project. I have a lot of energy for. Mm-hmm. You know, the energy, it's not the kind of thing where you buy. I once bought a 1947 Cadillac limousine, and I was going to restore it just perfect. Mm-hmm. And I started doing that, and I realized then, you know, what I got myself my hands on. And the energy couldn't stay up with that Cadillac, so I eventually sold it halfway done. But 2 years ago, as a matter of fact. But, you know, with this book, the energy really stays up. Because I'll tell you what keeps me going is the positive remarks I've gotten from people I've interviewed. I think they all want to have finally some recognition because they haven't gotten it any other way. Literally, like Billy Barty, you know, is very excited when I come over to help me in any way. Mm. You know? People like Bill Stella, with Engineer Bill.
Oh, you know, yeah.
20 years that I'm going to be printing some of the pictures, and he digs out his whole closet. They find things that they forgot they had, and you know. So after Clampett, you were
many of the people who had been with the animation unit during the war wound up working at a place called Industrial Films. And Industrial Films got its... It was a collection of lefties, for the most part. It got its big jump by doing an animated cartoon for...
When you say lefties, you mean literally left-handed?
No. left-wing liberal types.
All right.
Great rapport with each other politically.
Uh-huh.
And Industrial Films had got a big jump forward when they were commissioned by the CIO to do about a 15-minute animated cartoon plugging the re-election of Roosevelt in 1944. Mm-hmm. Indeed, my wife tells me, though I don't remember it, my wife tells me that we worked on that. That I did in-betweens for it at John Hubley's house on a couple of occasions. Hmm. That drifted out of my memory. So if that happened, she remembers. I didn't. But many of them were working for Industrial Films, and about the time that I was out of Beanie, Industrial Films changed its name to United Productions of America, terrible name, which was shortened to UPA, and finally became UPA, standing for nothing at all. Again, recommended by somebody who'd known me. I think it was probably Bill Hertz at that time. I joined UPA in, I guess it was 49 or 50, as a co-writer with Phil Eastman. Wonderful, gentle, amusing guy, funny guy. And we worked for about two and a half years at UPA. We did the early Magoos, not the first Magoo, but we did all the Magoos after that for the next couple of years. And I worked with Bob Cannon on some of the things that he did, with Ted Parmalee. And of course, the big thing that Phil and I did, one of the first things we worked on together was Gerald McBoing-Boing. Mm-hmm. Which had been bought, Ted Geisel.
Bill mentioned that also. And I recently interviewed Marvin Miller. He did the voices for that.
Yeah, very talented fellow too. I worked with Marv when I was at UPA and again when I was at Sutherland later.
He's a fun guy.
Yeah.
He really is. When you hear him talk, it's like listening to Santa Claus.
Yeah, Oh, he's got that. He's got that big voice and a great fund of stories. One of the great schmoozers of our time.
He laughs at himself, and I like that.
But Ted Geisel, Dr. Seuss, was known with a good friend of the people at UPA, and he had this record that the great Gildersleeve had made of a poem, the Child McBoing Boing. And he sold it to UPA as a great idea for an animated cartoon, except that they ran into this little problem, which was that what you were dealing with was sound. And animation is a visual medium. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? How does it wind up? What's the big ending? How does it work out? So Phil and I put the second act and the denouement in it that it required, and then it worked as a picture. Specifically, we had the kid in danger. He was trying to hop freight, so you really cared about him particularly. Mm-hmm. Are we out of tape yet?
No.
Okay. And then we got the end thing where we had Gerald do a whole scene, and I don't know if you remember the picture or not, but he's as a sound effect.
I remember the
plays. He becomes a hero. He becomes the star of a radio show called mm-hmm. Silent Sam Steelheart, who never says anything. But we constructed a whole sound thing, the horse riding into town, the spurs jingling, the saloon door opening and closing, the gunshots firing, the heels walking out, and the horse galloping off again. The whole little scene. Everybody cheered. So it worked out. It was very successful. And particularly since it had the talents of Bob Cannon, a fine designer and a good picture maker, and Gail Cubitt, who was one of the best modern composers and who was just slavering at the idea of doing an entire musical score which would be integrated and at times dictate the motion.
Some of the
wildest arguments in the world were Gail Cubitt and Bob Cannon going at each other. And Miller, of course, did a remarkable job of just laying his animation in, or his narration in, right on a beat off beat.
He does that very
A great fusion of talents, and of course it got the Academy Award that year. It was a big breakthrough. Then we went on working on the series. I guess the other memorable one that's been playing for a while was A Telltale Heart, which Fred Grebel and I worked on adapting to the animation medium and running a narration, which was very interesting to tell that whole story. And I think we had 6 minutes at the time, when Poe didn't write it that way at all, you know, and Poe had no ending to his story. So again, it was a matter of adapting, and I listened to it at the last Filmex thing where they ran it. I listened to it, and I had to write Poe, which was interesting, and I defy anybody to listen to that thing and know where Poe leaves off and Scott begins. Because it's just, I had to write in that same mood, same imagery and whatnot. Anyway, that was a lot of fun. Some other ones. I did two pictures. One was for the American Cancer Society. And it was an interesting problem because they had the American Cancer Society trying to get people to look for the seven symptoms of cancer and so forth, had been relying on scare tactics, scare the hell out of people.
Yeah.
They did too well. They scared them so much that people wouldn't go anywhere near a doctor.
Yeah.
So they came to UPA and they said, "Can you give us a funny picture that will get people to know about the seven danger signals of cancer?" So I wrote, I think it was Bill Danch and I wrote a thing called Man Alive. And Man Alive is still being shown. Now, that's been 20 years anyway, 25 maybe. But so that was a thing of a very long live picture. Okay, and then in the middle of my happy days at UPA, or at least they get happier as the years go on. I was miserable while I was there. Jeez, miserable. I was never in. Always tried to make the in group. Never made the in group.
It was really clicky there.
As I say, most of the people who have been there have been people who worked together for the last 5 or 10 years, anyway, and knew each other socially. And I was in that outfit. I was still the raw boned yucker from the Midwest, you know, the Denver kid with the funny jokes. So I was very happy to be hooked up with a hot studio. Uh-huh. And I did make very good friends there. But as most things do, it gets better in retrospect. Looking back on, looking at some of the pictures and remembering the conditions under which they were made, it was not the happiest time in the world. And of course it was made even worse because at that time the big Red Scare hit. And it smacked UPA very, very hard. I guess that nobody will ever know the true story of the folding of UPA. But it had to do in large part with the political background of some of the guys who were the founders and wheels there, mm-hmm. and with unconscionable and direct blackmailing by the IATSC. And by a little organization called the Hollywood Committee for the Preservation of American Ideals, which was composed mainly of Hedda Hopper, John Wayne, and Roy Brewer, who was head of the IA, who used this occasion to just about wipe out militant unionism in the whole industry, including the Screen Cartoonists Guild. So that was largely the demise of UPA. Phil Eastman got caught up in it, called before the committee and so forth. Some of the other people were able to make deals, which was the most venal thing of all, I suppose. They were able to make deals where their names, while not being taken off the list, would be put down so that the committee might be out of town before their names came up. And there were rumors of payoffs and whatnot. At any rate, Phil, having been cited and having made his appearance before the committee, whom he told to go fly a kite, got fired. Well, nobody was supposed to get fired for that reason, you see, because there was nothing illegal about what he had done. It was just what these people said. So they fired me, too. They fired Eastman and me on the grounds that they did not need that story unit. They were going to cut back on their production, et cetera, et cetera. And this made the reasonable thing. So both of us got heaved out at that time. That was in 51, I believe, late 51. 52, I hooked up with an outfit called John Sutherland Productions. And I guess I got my right-wing bona fides there, because I spent the next 4 years writing propaganda films for big business. General Motors, DuPont, American Petroleum Institute, every fat cat who could afford $50,000 to $100,000 for a propaganda cartoon, we were on the list. Oh, I lived high on the hog for a while.
What were some of the characters? Were there any certain characters?
No. Each one of these organizations usually had a pitch to make. The American Petroleum Institute, of course, wanted to get something on what the freebie circuit, the chicken croquette circuit, where you distribute free films if people will run them. Was at that time, I don't know whether it still is or not, a a very big part of the film business. These people were commissioning hundreds of pictures every year, which they would show free if somebody would watch them. Mm-hmm. The American Petroleum Institute did a cartoon on the depletion allowance and why the depletion allowance was a necessary and vital part of the oil industry. Mm-hmm. Kind of the thing that the Standard Oil is doing on their minute spots now.
Yeah.
These were a little more blatant than that. An outfit called Harding College, which got most of its money from right-wing sources, produced a number of cartoons, very, very conservative right-wing cartoons about the, you know, damning all kinds of national planning and one-worlders and all that. They were done, they were amusing and good propaganda. The DuPont Corporation, faced with a unionizing drive.
You were making good money, but you really weren't.
Oh, no. It was great to go back to New York and live high on the hog.
But you didn't feel really.
Yeah, I quit. I went in to quit from, I guess, about four times. I went in and told John, I can't do it anymore. I just can't do it anymore. And about that time, he starts stuffing money in my mouth. Yeah, so my plaints got less and less noisy. And finally, when I got enough money stuffed in my mouth, I'd shut up and go back to doing it again. The last time, though, he offered me a whopping raise. He'd already made me a vice president. And I said, no, don't make me a vice president. I did that for a while. It just meant you had to show up at meetings, that's all.
Yeah.
Didn't bring any more than that. So I went back to being an ordinary writer, but he offered me some whopping thing like it was something like double the salary or whatever. And at that point, it didn't make any difference. It just didn't make any difference. That is the only job in my whole life that I ever quit. Because I'm a very conservative fellow when it comes to bouncing around from position to position. But I quit that one in 1956 and went back to UPA as a... the hell was it? A cockamamie title they gave me. Assistant producer, assistant to the producer, associate to the producer, some strange title. And what it was, they were trying to do this CBS Boing Boing show for no money at all. And I was supposed to go around and funny things up because they had brought in a bunch of artists, great artists, but they didn't know very much about jokes. So I was supposed to go around and joke it up. Well, it's very difficult to joke up an artist who does not want to be joked up. But I did a little ramrodding and a little troubleshooting with some pictures that were in a jam. Spent the time there until that, I guess, got on the air and they stopped production. I think it was about that time that they did the first Magoo feature, which was Magoo's 1001 Nights, and I was dialogue director on that one, put the whole track together for them. That was...
I have a nice big picture of that at home.
56, and I freelanced writing television commercials for quartet films, mainly. And that was pretty good, too. Once I got used to the idea that eventually some money was going to come in. It might not come in regularly, but given a month or two, it would all even out. And Quartet was very good about paying me even when commercials were not made, which was a very big step in the industry at that time.
Yeah.
If you wrote a script, you only got paid for it if they bought it. But no matter how many spots I wrote, they paid for them, mm-hmm. which was very nice for me and very nice for them. Because I did some good spots for him. In 58, I got a call from Charlie Shows, whom I had not seen in, I guess, since the Clampett days of 10 years back. And Shows says, hey, are you interested in writing a pilot? And I said, sure. So he said, meet me down at someplace at Yucca and Argyle, I guess it was. Seamus Culhane, who was the head of an animation studio in the East, and a good buddy of all of the people, a good buddy of the Hearses. Seamus Culhane wanted to start a West Coast unit and he wanted to produce an animated cartoon for television. He called in as his producer, West Coast producer, Jay Ward. And Jay had done the Crusader Rabbit series, a very successful series with Alex Anderson, in a couple of years before in San Francisco. So Jay and Charlie Shows and I met, and we talked over a series to be called Phineas Fox. And it was a pretty clever little notion. I still got one of the pilots around somewhere. And we worked together on that first pilot. And then it dropped into the great beyond. Jay had some differences with Seamus Culhane, probably on who was going to be boss. He pulled out. Then Charlie wrote some commercials, wrote some additional pilots for the series, which they didn't like, and asked me if I would write it. So I wrote maybe half a dozen additional pilots of that series, did a little story continuity, sent them back, and they dropped into the well, and I never heard anything more about Phineas Fox. But about 4 months later, I guess it was, I got a call from Jay. And he said, I'm in town. Would you like to talk about writing something? Sure. So I went to see Jay, who was staying at a place called the Andalusia Apartments. They still exist. He still has the same apartment there, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right across the street from the Garden of Allah, which I think had just been torn down or was just being torn down at the time that we got together. It was 58 anyway. And it was had been designed, I guess, by the same people who designed the Garden of Olives. It looked exactly like it. And it was the it was a beautiful little place. We worked together. And he had several story ideas, which he and Alex Anderson had worked up. And one of them was called The Frostbite Falls Follies. And it was to be a musical show, like a variety show, with all these crazy animals in some little, originating theoretically from some little teeny town called Frostbite Falls in Minnesota. They had submitted it as a pilot, and nobody bought it. But Jay was entranced. He liked these two characters, the moose and the squirrel. And Jay had already named the moose Bullwinkle, and the squirrel Rocky. Named Bullwinkle was named after a used car dealer in Berkeley.
Oh, really?
Jay thought that was the funniest name he'd ever heard, Clarence Bullwinkle. And so he named the moose Bullwinkle and asked, you know, if could we do an adventure strip with him. So Jay and I worked on the first episode of the Bullwinkle, which called Rocky and His Friends at the time, because we thought that Rocky was going to be the star. And we also came up with the idea for a fairy story satire called Fractured Fairy Tales. And I guess I really forget what the third episode was. I know we had three. I don't think Dudley was there yet. He may have been. And so a friend of Jay's name Leonard Key, and an associate of his named Roger Carlin, had formed a thing called Carlin Key Productions. And they promoted a deal with a man who was the vice president of Dancer Fitzgerald and Sample. And like many things that Len had been connected with, certainly subsequent to that, if not before, it was just slightly gamey. It was an offbeat and slightly illegal thing, largely because the vice president of Dancer Fitzgerald and Sample had a piece of the action, which is unethical. And because it was sold on the basis that it could be done in Mexico. I knew nothing about this at all. I just knew that they were promoting the thing or were talking to ABC and to NBC. And it looked as if the deal was going to go through, and I was delighted. Mm-hmm. Well, Jay got sick right when the things are coming to a head, Jay is out of it. He had some kind of breakdown. He'd been flying back and forth to the coast. He's terrified of flying. And he had some kind of seizure on a transcontinental plane over Salt Lake City, and the plane landed. That's how serious it was. The plane turned back and landed halfway across the country. And Jay has never stepped in an airplane since. So he was ill, and we were talking to the people at General Mills and to the network people. And we met at the Beverly Hills Hotel. I get out of the car and be going up the steps. Len Key says, "No. If you hear somebody talk about doing this in Mexico, don't be surprised, because that's where it's going to be done." It's the first I heard of the Mexican operation.
Yeah.
So, of course, the question came up almost instantly. Somebody said to me, "Can it really be done in Mexico?" And I said, "Certainly it can be done in Mexico."
Go on. How would you describe him as a character?
Well, that's very easy, because Peabody was a copy. We wanted a very, very smart dog.
Wally Cox kind of.
No, actually he's modeled after Clifton Webb.
Oh, really?
His delivery and his attitude, his whole relationship with Sherman, the boy, is that of a rather testy and epicene schoolteacher. Has very little affection for Sherman, but he's a very cold, fishy kind of a guy. And
all this is interesting to hear. This is
he was modeled after Clifton Webb.
Yeah.
And as soon as that character was set, then you knew how he was going to react, and nothing ever fazed Peabody. Nothing fazed him at all. He was wonderful to write for.
You know, when I first heard June begin to talk, I heard Rocky. You know, you can hear that when you first hear her talk.
Yeah.
You hear at times you hear Rocky.
Yeah.
And at times I hear Sherman, not Sherman, but Peabody. I hear Peabody out of you sometimes. I think it's those glasses help too. can you give me just a little Bullwinkle? I mean.
Well, certainly. What would you like me to say?
Oh, there it is.
This is not Bill Scott doing it, of course. We really have a moose here.
It sounds a little bit like. Phil Silvers.
Now it sounds like Red Skelton. That's what
it
sounds.
Oh yeah.
Great story. At one time, NBC had it was NBC or ABC had moved the Bullwinkle Show to night. It was running at 7:30, prime time. And as part, in order to keep things current, because our lead time in animation was so bloody long, and Bullwinkle was best when he was being irreverent and topical and all those things. We used a puppet, the puppet Bullwinkle. Mm-hmm. About that time, we started getting letters threatening to sue us for everything. Because, you know, we didn't worry about things like, was anybody going to sue? Jay always invited people to sue.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when Durward Kirby said he was going to sue us, his attorney sent a letter saying he was going to sue. Jay said, "Please sue us. We will pay your attorney's fees." Because you could not get better publicity for the show than being sued over a joke.
Yeah.
Great. Anyway, got a letter from Red Skelton's attorneys. He said, "The Bullwinkle voice is obviously copied from Skelton's character of Clem Cadiddlehopper. Mm-hmm. Mr. Skelton says that if you do not cease and desist, now we are going to sue, et cetera, et cetera." So Bullwinkle went on the air the next night, I guess it was. And he said, "We have just received a letter from Mr. Red Skelton. And he says that my voice sounds just like his character, Clem Cadiddlehopper. That is ridiculous. To show you how ridiculous it is, I will now do my imitation of Red Skelton doing Clem Cadiddlehopper. Hello, everybody. This is Clem Cadiddlehopper speaking. Now, you see how different? So, we heard no more from Mr. Skelton. We didn't hear any more from. Oh, yes, we did hear. Much later, we heard from Durward Kirby, who knew nothing about it. And he was terribly embarrassed that the thing had happened at all. His agent, I guess, got up in the air about using his name for a magic hat. And he was not that way at all. But indeed, and nice thing also was that by the time the network ever got hold of anything, we were already far down the line in production and the deadline was already passed. So they hadn't very much opportunity to change anything. The only time we really had to button things up in a hurry was when we did a series on box tops, that taking the premise of the real hard currency in the world is the box top. That's the thing you can always trade for something. Somebody was counterfeiting box tops. We found out that we weren't kidding. That was really true. That was hard currency, and you couldn't talk about that.
Yeah.
We had to button up the box top story in about 4 episodes and get rid of it because, goodness, that was a terrible thing to do.
How about the one with the pulling out of the hat number?
These were little bridges which we were asked to do because when we got to the show being syndicated, sometimes didn't put it together like we put it together. Sometimes they just chop it apart and put all kinds of odd things in it. But these were designed as 15 or 10 or 5-second bridges in between episodes or leading into commercials so that you wouldn't come out of a cartoon and right into a commercial. From there, you'd have a little easement. At that time, it was thought necessary to have some kind of easement. Right now, of course, they don't do that anymore. But they were dreamed up just for that.
Now, did you write all of the ideas for pulling out of the hat number?
Mm-hmm.
And now you mentioned the next one we have to come up to now is Dudley Do-Right. That's another voice you.
That's a Jay character. He wanted a Mountie. I drew the first Dudley Do-Right, and Jay, I think, Jay got the name for him. He wanted to call him Dudley after Dudley Nightshade, who was his villain in Crusader Rabbit. But he wanted this is going to be a hero, Dudley, so it was Dudley Do-Right, and that was I believe Jay's name for him.
And you say you drew the first drawing. How did he describe it to you?
Oh, he didn't describe it. He just said, draw a heroic Mountie. So I drew a
guy
with a great Roman nose and a protruding jaw and the hat sitting squarely across his head like Nelson Eddy. Mm-hmm. And
what is his character like? How would you describe
Dudley? Oh, he's a hero. All our heroes are consciously heroes. They all know they're playing parts. But he is a real dolt, and he is is constantly being put upon by Snidely Whiplash, and of course Dudley sounds best because he's playing against the wild character that Hans Conried made out of Snidely. Snidely was so rotten and such a big, big performer in everything that he did.
Yeah.
But when Dudley comes in with this standard square kind of diction, he sounds
a different form of Peabody. Different kind.
Yeah, except that Dudley never has an answer. Peabody was never phased. Dudley was always phased. He never knew what was happening. He always had, and he would deal in these enormous cliches, which we later adapted his character and his voice to be Tom Slick when we did the Super Chicken series. Mm-hmm. Use the same voice and the same attitude. Man whose life was composed of cliches. And anytime you moved out of the cliche, you had no idea what was happening.
Did you have a book of cliches you reached in?
No. Just figured out what would he say at this particular time. Uh-huh. If they were anything, they would sound like old silent movie subtitles. It's the kind of dialogue you used to get out of them. Uh-huh. Or 10/23 drama, melodrama.
So, Tom Slick was about the last thing you did for Jay Ward?
Well,
or did you still work on some of the Captain Crunch things?
Well, after Bullwinkle was still being made. And I think we moved into Fractured Flickers next. I think that was the next one. Or it may have been George. I forget which.
Now you wrote for Fractured Flickers as well.
Yeah.
And did you do voices incidental?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. We did a half hour, which meant that we had to produce.
That was a lot of fun to do.
About 18 minutes of new material for each program, and we dealt with a man named Raymond Rohauer, who had access to a great deal of old film, old silent footage. And we got a great wad of stuff to use, plus a lot of old features and such. I acted, in essence, as story editor or head writer on that particular series. I had my own responsibility. We usually would try to do one major fracturing of a feature. Take a whole feature and just boil it down to about a 5-minute thing. It had nothing to do with the original. Mm-hmm. I did most of those. George Atkins did a couple of them. Chris Jenkins did a couple. But I did most of the main boiling down things. Then the other ones would be much shorter segments that were all satires of the current scene. And that was another one that we had all kinds of writers on that one. I can't even remember their names. Well, Chris Jenkins did a lot. Lloyd Turner, Chris Hayward, Hal Parrots, Art Nadell, George, Chris, Jim Critchfield. And, the tough thing was that this was not just writing. Every one of those guys had to be able to handle a moviola, and he would do his own cutting, or at least indicate his own cuts and his own splices to put his own piece of film together. So all these writers essentially were working with film for the first time in their lives, actually handling film. And we could always Atkins was superb at taking it. Piece of film and letting it run off the track so that it was cutting itself in half as the moviola went. So he'd have part of the film going up this way and part of it going off on the floor. Yeah. We could always tell when that was happening. We heard that sound.
So did you take little pieces and work on them separately, or were there a time did you sit in a session together and throw ideas around?
No. Every writer was pretty much on his own. There was no time to do anything else. We just had to turn that yardage out. It was a fairly low budget and a tight deadline, and I think a good deal of optimistic thinking at the beginning of it on how fast this stuff could be turned out. It was a difficult thing to do. We were at the end of Fractured Flickers. We were giving the finished film to a first answer print to the network like about 2 hours before it was going to go on the air. It was that close.
Panicking.
Really, really panic time. Very frantic stuff.
Well, the program came out that way. the kind of same Jay Ward pace.
But also we had a slight easement because we had Hans Conry interviewing a star on each one of the programs. That was fascinating because we seldom knew who the star was going to be until maybe a day before, sometimes not even then.
Did you have any particular favorites that came in that you really, really liked?
Pat Carroll did a marvelous job for us. She got into the whole swing of it, and she did one of the best.
Really?
They did a call-in program where nobody called in, and it was a funny sketch. Mm-hmm. That was my job. That's another thing. I think I wrote every one of those, if memory serves, wrote every one of those interviews. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we would find out in the morning who our star was going to be. And in the morning, Hans would shoot his introduction to the various segments that we were going to do. He'd introduce the show and give his two little jokes at the beginning, and then introduce the first segment, and we'd do another introduction. We finished, and we'd break for lunch. I would all this time be in the office of the studio in which we were shooting him.
Writing questions.
Whacking away at an interview. And we got about 3 minutes of interview or 3 minutes of sketch. We just give it to the teleprompter man. Yeah. And he would go off and do his teleprompter thing and come back at 2 o'clock, the people would show up. And then they just run through it. There was seldom more than one rehearsal. They just run through it once they knew what the next words were going to be. And then we'd shoot it. Again, very, very fast scheduling. And of course, you couldn't do anything. They just had to sit there and be funny, because there was no time for setups, no time for changing your lighting. You just had to get 3 minutes of yardage on that, on the film.
Yeah.
So it was some of them stand up pretty well. Some of them are pretty dull now, but some of the interviews and the sketches stand up pretty well. Some of the fractured flickers, I still get a big yawk out of when I see them. But it helps if you know the original picture, I must say.
Yeah. I haven't seen them in an awful long time.
We got one of the great horror films of all time, Konrad Veidt doing The Hands of Orlach, the guy who's the concert pianist whose hands are severed, and they manage to sew on the hands, and they're the hands of a murderer, and he can't control them. You know, it's pretty creepy. I made it into a 5-minute commercial for Rough Red Hands. I think that was it. And it was terribly funny to me, because you see the original thing with Veidt being just as desperately dangerous and awful as he could be, and his cockamamie words are coming out of him.
Yeah.
Well, I got a kick out of that. Some Douglas Fairbanks things that were funny.
Yeah. He leans her way back and says something bizarre.
Yeah. So they were, that was a wild series, though, as they almost all are. St. George of the Jungle was the same way. We were right down to 2 minutes before airtime when we finally got down to the 17th episode of George of the Jungle.
Really?
Yeah, it was. So what else do you want to know?
Okay, have we talked about everything you've done for Jay Ward now? Have we covered just about everything you could say?
We did a series, which is really back in the dim mists, because I haven't seen it for so long, called Hoppity Hooper. I think we did 26, I think 26 or 52 half hours of that. And that was a straight half hour show. I tried that whole writing 18 minutes of material in a straight story. And I really don't remember too much about that. I know I did a different kind of a goof. I did Fillmore, who was a dunce, but he was the duh, type dunce. John T. Savoni kind of character. But again, working with Hans Conried, who was doing one of his nasty con men, worked out well. And we used a little gal named Chris Allen, so she wouldn't sound too much like Rocky as Hoppity Hooper, the frog. So we did that. And I think that was about the last of the cartoon series. About that time, we did a feature called The Crazy World of Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, I remember.
And
I remember seeing it, but I remember hearing about it.
And then we recut the General, got the finest complete negative of Keaton's picture of the General, and recut that so we can get rid of the of all the dialogue titles and run it as a straight film.
Were these last two pictures you mentioned released in pictures in the movie theaters?
Yeah, but they were released on a string, I think, or a rubber band, because they snapped back very quickly. No, they're limited release. We had an art house release on both of those, and that really doesn't do you any good. We did, however, do another one called The Golden Age of Buster Keaton, which may be the definitive Keaton film, and that's going to be opening July the 20th in England.
Now, was that Jay's interest? Or?
Yeah. We wanted
an old movie buff.
Yeah. And we've also done a film on W.C. Fields, using W.C. Fields, one on using the Robert Benchley shorts. And again, an interesting job of recutting, snapping things up a little bit, shortening so that you can get a whole overview of what the character is like and the whole oeuvre that he's working in.
What are you doing now for Jay Ward?
Well, I guess last week I must have written my 350th Cap'n Crunch commercial.
Really?
Yeah. I guess we've been dealing with Quaker now for 15 years or so. And got renewed again this year, so I guess it's going to be another one.
The second longest running commercial character. Besides Tony the Tiger, from what Dawes tells me.
That may be. I hadn't heard that. I guess it must be. It's a very, very...
I think Tony the Tiger is the
long
one that beats the record.
Yeah.
And then Captain Crunch is next in line.
Evermore. Yeah. Captain Crunch was dreamed up. First off, nobody was at the studio one day, except Helen Hansen. And... somebody called up and said, would you people be interested in submitting some characters for some commercials? And Helen said, sure. So they sent us the information. Jay would have said no. Jay didn't want to do it at all.
Yeah.
But she said, sure. And we were god-awful busy on something else at the time. So we turned the whole project over to Alan Burns, who was writing for us at the time. Alan was also the guy who was working with Jay on publicity, promotion, all the crazy things that we were doing, and coming up with the ideas for them. Alan was a funny artist and a very fertile mind in this field. So we sort of dumped it on Al. I said, here, you come up with it. And he came up. They had the name of the character, Cap'n Crunch. They knew what that was going to be, and they just wanted to see what we'd come up with. And Alan came up with this whole idea of the crew and the guppy and the captain who had been sailing for all these years and the adventures and the world he'd live in, and wrote the first Cap'n Crunch commercials. And they bought them, fortunately, and we've been doing them ever since. Alan, of course, went on in a period of the doldrums, or when he just got fed up with writing so much for so little, went on to write for some of the major comedy shows, and then, of course, hooked up with, can't think of the other guy's name, to first write and then produce the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Mm. And he was head writer on Mary Tyler Moore Show and then producer of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And so now he's a producer, a major producer with MTM Productions, which has also turned out
countless
Phyllis
spin-offs.
Spin-offs. But extremely...
The Ted Knight Show is the latest one.
Yeah.
I think every one of the characters has her own show.
But Alan is a very, very fertile mind, a very funny fellow. He did, again, Alan was, goes back to Fractured Flickers too, I believe.
Mm-hmm. What do you do with your time that you're not working with Jay, and what do you like to do? Are you I see you have a lot of books here on Europe. Have you gone to Europe?
Well, we're going to go to Europe the last part of June. We'll be there for a while. Now, we don't do too much traveling, however. I'm very active in my local church, where we have a drama group, and we do a number of plays there. I love to build sets, and I love to act. God knows I need to keep my hand in. So we do a great deal of work for and in the church, Episcopal Church.
During the Bullwinkle years, were you based out here?
Did I live in Tujunga?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I moved here in 52 and been here ever since.
You're way up here. Long
yeah, I know. When I first came out to Tujunga or up to Tujunga, I said to myself, I had some friends who really lived in La Crescenta, which is much farther in town. They lived in La Crescenta, and we took some their kids to what was then called Pop's Willow Lake, which was a swimming pool, an open-air swimming pool out down the road a piece. I said to myself, who in God's name would ever live this far out? This is just ridiculous. You're out, you know, and it's quite true. The Angeles National Forest starts about two blocks up there. But at that time we were living in Hawthorne. And when it finally got so noisy that we couldn't hear each other at the dinner table, we moved
to the airport.
Oh yeah, the jets were just coming in at that time, and and they were building engines also at North American at that time. They were testing engines, which was even worse, because they'd run and they wouldn't pass over. They just keep on roaring for God knows how long. We moved to North Hollywood, into a terrible, terrible place. Stayed there only a year. And a friend of mine named Tony Rivera, layout man, lived up here. And we saw his place, which was very much like this one, fell in love with it.
Nice place.
At the time that we were visiting him, the guy who built the house was there, a fellow named Victor Cease. Strange fellow. And he said, well, I'm building three more of those down the hill, Bill. Would you like to take a look at them? Well, sure, yeah. Came down to this house and the one below it and the one below that were all built at the same time. I walked into this place. That was it. Boy, I knew, had to have it. Just had to have it.
Yeah. So you happy out here?
I don't. We were barely out of escrow in the other place that we bought.
Yeah.
So we moved in, and it was a much smaller place at that time, but it has the marvelous advantage of having a completely flat roof, which means that you can just keep on adding things as long as you can find space to add them on and some way to get in and out of the various rooms, because you don't have to worry about roof pitches, which we did. We put that end of the house on. We put this end of the house on. We pushed the front of it out a little bit and kept on adding things till we had what we wanted. And we have we sort of built ourselves in like a turtle in its shell.
Has a Danish modern look to it.
Yeah, that was very big.
That's why I asked about Europe, but it kind of has that feel.
Yeah. No, but it was ridiculous. We bought the original house, three bedrooms, two baths, for $14,500. And it turned out cheaper than that because part of that was in a second, which Victor sold back to us at two-thirds of it. So it was probably about $12,500 that the house cost. And put another $10,000 into it or more.
It'll go now for $125,000.
It's about 100 G's now. I'm afraid to go down and find out what the assessor's got it up to now.
Yeah.
But we never considered it an investment. It was a place we wanted to live on. We kept adding bedrooms to it. We now have four bedrooms and a den and three baths and a big yard out in the back. So it's been we've done that. That's part of what we do with our time.
What do you see in the future for yourself? More Captain Crunch commercials or?
Oh, I hope that hope that goes on for a while. They're usually they're fun to do, and they have those lovely residuals coming in. That's what really puts the jam on the bread. I would love to see us do more animation. We were approached a few months ago by ABC, who asked us to come up with some ideas for an after-school special. And they wanted to do something with literature. So we said we'd do them a boob on anything. We gave them a treatment on George of the Jungle, because ABC owns those characters as far as television is concerned, so it's a good deal for them in that respect. And we did a treatment on Around the World in 80 Days and Alibaba and the 40 Thieves and Treasure Island, all three of them with George as the main character, and then just taking the story and knocking it out. Well, it was deja vu time, because we heard from ABC in 1978 exactly what we heard from ABC in 1958. No, the kids aren't going to get it. It's too sharp. Kids don't dig satire. You know, we're having trouble. No, you can't put that in. And it does them no good. Showed him at the Bullwinkle show is still on the air after 20 years.
Well, it is the longest running cartoon program in history, in television cartoon program.
Yeah, one of. I think they're.
It is the longest running children's television cartoon series.
I know it is. It has never been off the air. Though you may have to get up early in the morning to see it sometimes. I think you have to get up at 6 o'clock in San Diego.
I had been watching it, it seemed like not that long ago, but it's not on now. Taken off. I think we're just about done. I brought some things for you to sign.
Oh, sure. But we're ready anytime they are.
I've been collecting squeeze toys of cartoon characters, and right now I have about 3,500 pieces. And that's been about a year, my girlfriend and I collecting. And where we go is Goodwills. And any place, garage sales, swap meets, collector's shows. And spent a lot of money at it. But I know that, you know, it's just, if you could see it, it's incredible. It's all set up on one side of my living room. The whole living room has 3,500 pieces set up, from little tiny characters to very large characters. And some of them are very old and some of them are pretty recent. I just got some recent ones I'll show you in a minute. But it's really something to see. And rather than personalize it, just your name would be best.
Sure.
Because that way I can, actually above his head would be better.
Okay.
Because I could frame him in a tighter frame.
Okay.
Peabody, can I just have a above his head, just because that way when people see it they'll know you did that. One of these days it's going to come out of my living room. My idea is to get it set up in a restaurant.
You want me to sign that one too?
Yeah. people I meet, I make them feel like John Hancock's after a while. Just Bill Scott's movie. I collect comic books, glassware, records.
Oh, you'd be a man after Jay's heart. He's one of the great collectors of our time.
I wasn't aware of it.
Hmm?
He collects too.
He collects everything, but he's a very astute collector of art.
Really?
Oh, God, he must have $500,000 worth of artifacts of various kinds. It's everything. He's into collecting old carousel horses, wooden Indians, Egyptian pieces. What the devil else? Very strange and wondrous stuff.
Sounds like the kind of stuff
that the apartment now is just... You can barely get in it now. You have to push the door open. It's just full of stuff.
Great. This one is to my girlfriend, Dion, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where do you want me to sign it? Down here? Up in there?
Right there. Hmm? Right next to Bowen.
Okay.
And I brought a Rocky to June, which she didn't see. Have you seen these, Bullwinkle?
No. No, I don't think I have.
Would you like one? I brought two of them.
No, would it just hang around here and get lost?
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking that if you could...
used to have a lot of this kind of thing around when my kids were growing up. They grew up with
the
two.
That's something I forgot to ask you about your children. How many children do you have?
I have three. I have one who is... My oldest boy, John, is a public defender with L.A. County. And my girl is a musician in Santa Cruz.
Hmm.
And my younger boy, Rob, is trying to be a musician.
How old is he now?
He's 20, 21.
So you have three?
Yeah, and the oldest one's 30.
If you could give me a Bill Scott on ears, I guess would be a good.
Yeah, let's see. Let me get something that writes on there.
Hmm? Oh, to write on this?
Yeah. What do you want?
Here's another one.
I'm afraid that'll just wipe off when it gets on the plastic.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Bill Scott, I guess, on the ear.
On the antler here?
Yeah, one on... Where could you sign it? On the nose, I guess, maybe?
That's probably best here. That's permanent.
I think it's going to work. Oh, yeah. How about... thing?
All right.
You designed a big job for a signature... Thank you for doing all that for me.
Alrighty.
And
glad to.
If you had a glossy of yourself, that would be helpful.
I do not. I have no pictures of it.
Can I take one of you now?
No.
Sure. Behind your desk?
Yes.
Do you play piano?
No, no. Jay gave me that for a Christmas present one time.
I thought I saw one kind of like it in the entryway there.
That was the band organ that Jay drove across the country in 1963.
Really?
Yeah. We were at that time the big thing was to get statehood for Moosylvania. And Jay and our publicity guy, Howard Brandy, got a van in which they rigged up to get that band organ in it. And they drove all across the country, stopping in every town where somebody would give them a plug. And then they put the band organ on the back of the thing and tow it around town, playing it. And plugging statehood for Moosylvania. And in one of those rare bits of timing, Jay wanted to present all the petitions at the White House. That was the idea. He was going to give the president these millions of signatures. I don't know how the hell many he had, but they were, you know, way hundreds of thousands anyway. To give these signatures to the president. And so we wound up trying to crash the White House gates right in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, we're lucky we still have him, as a matter of fact.
This is all from a shy man, huh?
Yeah, for a shy man, anybody who would appear on Johnny Carson's show with a wearing a rhinestone monocle to give him a 6-foot salami.
He did that?
Yep.
Boy, it doesn't sound like Jim.
It doesn't indeed.
It sounds like the craziness of Jim. Yeah.
But after he got on, he couldn't think of anything to say. Yeah, well, except that we just like to have fun. But it was but he doesn't do that anymore.
Other than me calling you back in a couple of days and telling you the pictures didn't work out. Actually, from this.
Are you getting too much backlight?
You know what? I just went and I, yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's better right there. I just came from seeing the other day Roy Rogers.
Uh-huh.
And he was an interesting interview. I mean, the guy really kept up his image.
Oh, yeah.
Kept it up.
Sure.
I was kind of impressed by that the man could. Why? Well, it wasn't fake class. It was like he believed it for so many years that it really
Certainly.
Was kind of classy.
Yeah.
Let's try some.
Like this.
The story of the.
You know, when it came down to taking pictures, you know what he did? Hmm. He went and he got his favorite jacket and the hat, white hat and red scarf. And he looked just like he did. Right out of his movies. Why don't we try you kind of like you're really playing.
Oh, all right.
You can just kind of turn over your head this way. How's that? And Jay gave this to you as a gift.
Yeah, I just showed up on Christmas.
Really? What do you mean you just showed up and you just came?
I had no idea. Yeah, a guy came up and said, I have something here for you. It was about 11 o'clock at night. And I go out there and there's this damn big orange piano coming down the steps.
And had you played piano?
No, I didn't play piano. My daughter played piano. My wife plays a little bit.
Paul Mayer's Children's Television Archive.